in order that they might bestow his title on Queen Victoria, who became Empress of India in 1877. When Alim Khan of the Mangit dynasty assumed power as Emir of Bukhara in 1910, the Russians had already controlled his homeland for two generations, and he ruled more as a pampered puppet than did his ancestors of earlier centuries. 731 years after the first tribal Hurultai met on the shores of the Blue Lake by Black Heart-Shaped Mountain in 1189, a much different group, also calling itself a Hurultai, but consisting of the delegates of the Bukhara Communist Party, met to depose his last descendant. In the final week of August, he fled Bukhara, and after a brief attempt to mount a resistance from Tajikistan, he found refuge under British protection in Afghanistan, where he lived for the remainder of his life. As the Emir departed, Bolshevik forces under Mikhail Vasilyevich Frunze attacked the citadel in Bukhara, the same fortress where precisely 7 centuries earlier the spirit banner of Genghis Khan had led the Mongols to their first victory in Central Asia. On September 2, 1920, Frunze reported to Lenin that the fortress of Old Bukhara was taken today following a powerful attack by Red and Bukharian units. With a dramatic flourish, he added that tyranny and coercion had been vanquished. The red flag of revolution is floating over the Registan. Throughout most of the 20th century, Russia and China maintained an accord dividing the homeland of Genghis Khan between them, with China occupying Inner Mongolia, the part south of the Gobi, and the Soviet Union occupying the other half, Outer Mongolia, north of the Gobi. The Soviets turned Mongolia into a buffer zone that they kept largely empty between themselves and the Chinese. Just as the British executed the sons and grandsons of the last Mughal emperor of India in the 19th century, the Soviets purged the known descendants of Genghis Khan remaining in Mongolia in the 20th century, marching whole families into the woods to be shot and buried in unmarked pits, exiling them into the gulag of Soviet camps across Siberia, where they were worked to death, or simply causing their mysterious disappearance into the night of history. In April 1964, the official Soviet newspaper Pravda issued a stern warning against attempting to place the bloodthirsty barbarian Genghis Khan on the pedestal as a historically progressive personage. The Chinese communists countered the Soviet attack by charging that the Russians should be more appreciative of the Mongols, since their invasion of Russia gave the Russians the opportunity to get acquainted with a higher culture. No matter how offended the Mongols may have been by the Soviet attacks on their hero, they remained fiercely loyal to the Russians. The ensuing persecutions in Mongolia destroyed a whole generation of linguists, historians, archaeologists, and other scholars who specialized in topics tangentially connected to Genghis or the Mongol Empire. Somewhere in the 1960s, 8 centuries after the birth of Genghis Khan, his soul, the spirit banner that he had carried across Eurasia, disappeared from where the communist authorities had kept it. From the time of this purge, the soul of Genghis Khan has not been seen or accounted for. Many scholars assume that the authorities destroyed it in a final act of malice toward his soul. Still others hope that, just perhaps, the soul lies forgotten in some dusty basement or bricked-up room from which it will one day be brought out to lead and inspire the Mongols once again.
Epilogue: The Eternal Spirit of Genghis Khan. Is it our fault we have forgotten our history? Jargal Saihan. Genghis Khan's was the last great tribal empire of world history. He was the heir of 10,000 years of war between the nomadic tribes and the civilized world, the ancient struggle of the hunter and the herder against the farmer. It was a history as old as the story of the Bedouin tribes that followed Muhammad to smash the pagan idolatry of the city, of the Roman campaigns against the Huns, of the Greeks against the wandering Scythians, of the city dwellers of Egypt and Persia who preyed on the wandering tribes of Hebrew herders, and ultimately of Cain, the tiller who slew his brother Abel, the herder. The clash between the nomadic and urban cultures did not end with Genghis Khan, but it would never again reach the level to which he brought it. Civilization pushed the tribal people toward the ever more distant edges of the world. Chiefs such as Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse of the Lakota Sioux, Red Eagle of the Muscogee, Tecumseh of the Shawnee, and Shaka Zulu of South Africa valiantly but vainly continued the quest of Genghis Khan over the coming centuries. Without knowing anything about the Mongols or Genghis Khan, these other chiefs faced the same struggles and fought the same battles across Africa and throughout the Americas. But history had moved beyond them. In the end, sedentary civilization won the long world war. The future belonged to the civilized children of Cain, who eternally encroached upon the open lands of the tribes. Although he arose out of the ancient tribal past, Genghis Khan shaped the modern world of commerce, communication, and large secular states more than any other individual. He was the thoroughly modern man in his mobilized and professional warfare and in his commitment to global commerce and the rule of international secular law. What began as a war of extinction between the nomad and the farmer ended as a Mongol amalgamation of cultures. His vision matured as he aged, and as he experienced different ways of life. He worked to create something new and better for his people. The Mongol armies destroyed the uniqueness of the civilizations around them by shattering the protective walls that isolated one civilization from another and by knotting the cultures together. The great actors of history cannot be neatly tucked between the covers of a book and filed away like so many pressed botanical specimens. Their actions cannot be explained according to a specific timetable like the coming and going of so many trains. Although scholars may designate the beginning and ending of an era with exact precision, great historical events, particularly those that erupt suddenly and violently, build up slowly, and once having begun, never end. Their effects linger long after the action faded from view. Like the tingling vibrations of a bell that we can still sense well after it has stopped ringing, Genghis Khan has long passed from the scene, but his influence continues to reverberate through our time. In April 2000, I followed the trail that Temujin and his family probably took 8 centuries earlier when they fled from the attacking Merkit, who had come to kidnap Berta. After locating the likely spot of the attack on Temujin's camp, the direction from which the Merkit came, and the path by which the group fled, we set off to follow the chase from the steppe to the mountains. The local herding boys were themselves about the same age as the ones whose trail we were now retracing. They were just as skilled with horses as their ancient predecessors, and they wore the traditional Mongol del with the tightly wrapped sash of bright gold silk just below the waist. Except for the occasional baseball cap, sunglasses, or jeans worn under the del, their clothes were still the same heavy layers of wool, fleece, and felt garments worn by their ancestors. Our 9 horses, like those of Erlun's fleeing family, were geldings, and the descriptions of the horses in the secret history are so precise that we could have matched them up by age, color, shape, and other characteristics. Instead, we simply rode with the horses that an old and slightly drunk herder had designated as most appropriate for our task. We did not need to search for the route so much as merely follow the guidance and intuition of the nomads. They knew precisely how a horse and rider would get from here to there. They knew where the ice was too thin to cross the river, where the snow was too deep in the small depressions, and where a cluster of marmot burrows might trip one of the racing horses. The wind made the new snow dance around the horses' hooves as we slowly climbed the rocky slope of Burhan Khaldun, the most sacred mountain in Mongolia. The horse nervously snorted moist puffs of steam into the crisp air. His head jerked. Under the strain of a long, hard climb at such a thin altitude, his heart pounded so loudly that I heard it above the rushing wind, and I felt it throbbing up through my legs to my heart. When we paused in the bright, crystal-clear light, we saw all the way to the horizon in all directions, across the mountain peaks, boulder fields, winding rivers, and frozen lakes. When he had finished his work, Genghis Khan returned here, as he always had after each victory, for rest, recovery, and renewal. He had changed the world, but had allowed nothing to change in the land of his birth. Today, hawks soar overhead in spring, and the insects still sing in summer, just as they did in his day. Nomads move to the hills in autumn, and wolves prowl in winter. When I close my eyes, I can still hear the distant thunder of his horse's hooves as they gallop off to China, Europe, and India. Leaving the forested mountains and riding back to find our jeeps, we decided to return to where the story and our expedition began, the place where the Merkit kidnapped Bertha from Temujin. The steppe stretched to the horizon in every direction, barren of trees and unmarked by buildings, roads, fences, electric lines, or other scars of the modern world. During my repeated visits, I had learned to mark the land as the Mongols do, by the color of season. The brief green summer lured the mating birds. The yellow fall enticed the horses to race and goats to gnaw at the drying plants. The white winter would find camels wandering slowly up and down the frozen river, searching for patches of dried grass, and the brown spring provided only a time of waiting for new grass by the animals and the humans who lived off them. Isolated, remote, and unchanged by the centuries, this locale marks the place where Temujin became a man and changed the Mongols from a tribe into a nation. Upon our return to the windy place where we thought the abduction had occurred, our group grew quiet in the bitter wind that whipped around us. We had fulfilled a mission, and we returned to the spot with a new sense of amazement at what had happened here. The outline of many old campsites were clearly marked by large stones that once were used to tie down the gear in the fierce winds. The Mongol camps now lay cold and empty. Yet it seemed that if I only kicked the dust, I would feel the warmth of the smoldering ashes rising from the last campfire. If I brushed away the snow, I would see the prints of his horses in the frozen mud. The stones seemed to have been left quite casually, as though at any time now the owner might return, dust them off, and once again erect either a winter camp for his yaks and sheep, or an imperial capital of the world, whichever is most needed at the moment. We stood in a silent cluster in the whistling wind, tightened our jackets, pulled down our hats, and stared at the ground. One by one, members of the group walked away to gather a few stones and pile them on the spot in the way that nomadic people have marked important places for thousands of years. The senior horseman, a local headman, gathered some of the dried horse dung, piled it in front of the stones, and as others blocked the wind by spreading open their flowing dales, lit the dung in much the same way that a mother kindles the fire before the family erects their gear around it. Once the dung ignited, Professor Suchbater sprinkled some incense of finely ground cedar into the fire. The smell generated a soothing effect that softened the excitement of the long search and at the same time focused our attention on the fire itself. The smoke wafting from the incense and dung signaled the success and conclusion of this phase in our quest. All the men shuffled a little and gradually pulled themselves up more erectly. Every culture has its proper way to dress and appear respectful. For the Mongols, the three breast buttons had to be securely fastened, their collars pulled straight, and the sleeves of the dels pulled down to cover their wrists and part of the upper hand. Each man tightened the wide gold sash and then bloused out the upper part of the del to make it loose and full. When we had identified the place on our earlier passage through here, the herders had asked Professor Suchbater to mark the stone on this place so that everyone would know what had happened. A lady who lived nearby explained that because such knowledge was forbidden for so long, they wanted their children to know it now, for For them, the way to remember it was to have it carved in stone. All of the herders respected the elderly professor. They knew him from the years after the purge of scholars, when alone and at great risk to his life, he set out on his journey of more than 1,000,000 kilometers, tracing the route of Genghis Khan and relying on the hospitality of the herders to protect, house, and feed him in his quest. Now, after completing our journey, Professor Sukhbhatter consented to their request to erect a stone to commemorate the kidnapping of Berta from Temujin. It was quickly decided that he would write the text, Professor Jamyon Surin would design the calligraphy of the old Mongol script, and the students would find a stone and engrave it. After sending a student to fetch his well-worn almanac, Professor Sukhbhatter squinted through his smudged glasses to follow a long series of charts and diagrams. He made notes with a stubby pencil on a small slip of paper, performed some quick calculations, and looked up more charts in the almanac. He then announced the most propitious day on which the students should return to this spot to erect the stone. This piece of business behind us, Professor Toksurin pulled a bottle of vodka out from the hidden recesses of his dell, sprinkled it on the stones, threw some into the air, and touched it to his forehead. In some intimate way or other, each person connected directly back to the story we were researching. Toksurin had traveled this area many times with his teacher and mentor, the archaeologist Perle, and when the authorities put Perle in prison, they also arrested Toksurin's father for being too much of a nationalist. They sent his stepmother into internal exile far out in the country, and as the children of political prisoners, Toksurin and his younger siblings were turned out into the streets of Ulaanbaatar. In the months before the authorities came to take him away to the children's prison, he managed to heap enough dirt over a small shed outside of town to serve as a home for his siblings through the winter while they would be alone. After spending his teen years in prison and in forced service on a distant border, he resumed the archaeological work of his mentor. For each person, whether herder or scholar, the history around us was neither abstract nor distant. Their Mongol history cut through their lives as sharply as if the events had happened only last week. For me, the quest across Mongolia and back through time had begun in nearly childlike curiosity that had developed into an intellectual and scholarly quest. But for my Mongol colleagues, each step in our search grew much more personal and much more deeply emotional. Each day, as we understood better the hardships and heroism of their ancestors, we slipped farther back into time. Where we stood was not just another historical place. On this spot, the mother of the Mongol nation had been attacked, kidnapped, and ravished. When she was taken from him, the boy Temujin risked all, including his young life, to get her back. He rescued her. And for the rest of his life, he fought to keep his own people safe from outside attack, even though that meant that he would spend his life attacking outsiders. In the process, he changed the world, and he created a nation. They knelt before the small pile of smoking dung, sniffling and with tears pooling in the corners of their eyes. In the golden but dimming light of dusk, 8 centuries melted away. And the pain of that dawn of terror so long ago floated in the smoke around us. As the incense burned on the small mound of stones, each person stepped forward individually to honor this place. He took off his hat, knelt before the stones, touched his head to the frozen earth of this sacred spot, and then got up and walked slowly 3 times around the stones while tossing vodka into the air. Each person pulled out something as a small personal gift to leave on the stones. The stub of a sugar cube, a few matches, a candy wrapped in crinkling paper, a sprinkling of tea leaves. It was almost as though they wanted to reach back through the centuries to offer these small gifts of nourishment and warmth to the fleeing and frightened Berta as her kidnapper slung her on a horse and galloped away with her to an unknown future. It was as though the members of our muted group wanted to tell her, their mother, that everything would be all right, that she and they, her children, would survive it all for 8 more centuries. After all, they are still the children of the golden light, the offspring of a wolf and a doe, and in the wispy clouds of the eternal blue sky of Mongolia, the spirit banner of Genghis Khan still waves in the wind. To the young Mongols, never forget the Mongolian scholars who were willing to sacrifice their lives to preserve your history.
Afterward, the missing conqueror.
Genghis Khan was a doer. Washington Post, 1989. In 1937, the soul of Genghis Khan disappeared from the Buddhist monastery in central Mongolia along the River of the Moon below the Black Shankh Mountains where the faithful lamas had protected and venerated it for centuries. During the 1930s, Stalin's henchmen executed some 30,000 Mongols in a series of campaigns against their culture and religion. The troops ravaged one monastery after another, shot the monks, assaulted the nuns, broke the religious objects, looted the libraries, burned the scriptures, and demolished the temples. Reportedly, someone secretly rescued the embodiment of Genghis Khan's soul from the Shankh Monastery and whisked it away for safekeeping to the capital in Ulaanbaatar, where it ultimately disappeared. Through the centuries on the rolling, grassy steppes of Inner Asia, a warrior herder carried a spirit banner called a sult, constructed by tying strands of hair from his best stallions to the shaft of a spear, just below its blade. Whenever he erected his camp, the warrior planted the spirit banner outside the entrance to proclaim his identity and to stand as his perpetual guardian. The spirit banner always remained in the open air beneath the eternal blue sky that the Mongols worshipped. As the strands of hair blew and tossed in the nearly constant breeze of the steppe, they captured the power of the wind, the sky, and the sun, and the banner channeled this power from nature to the warrior. The wind in the horsehair inspired the warrior's dreams and encouraged him to pursue his own destiny. The streaming and twisting of the horsehair in the wind beckoned the owner ever onward, luring him away from this spot to seek another, to find better pasture, to explore new opportunities and adventures, to create his own fate in his life in this world. The union between the man and his spirit banner grew so intertwined that when he died, the warrior's spirit was said to reside forever in those tufts of horsehair. While the warrior lived, the horsehair banner carried his destiny. In death, it became his soul. The physical body was quickly abandoned to nature, but the soul lived on forever in those tufts of horsehair to inspire future generations. Genghis Khan had one banner made from white horses to use in peacetime, and one made from black horses for guidance in war. The white one disappeared early in history, but the black one survived as the repository of his soul. In the centuries after his death, the Mongol people continued to honor the banner where his soul resided. In the 16th century, one of his descendants, the Lama Zanabatsa, built the monastery with a special mission to fly and protect his banner. Through storms and blizzards, invasions and civil wars, more than 1,000 monks of the Yellow Hat sect of Tibetan Buddhism guarded the great banner, but they proved no match for the totalitarian politics of the 20th century. The monks were killed, and the spirit banner disappeared. Fate did not hand Genghis Khan his destiny. He made it for himself. It seemed highly unlikely that he would ever have enough horses to create a spirit banner, much less that he might follow it across the world. The boy who became Genghis Khan grew up in a world of excessive tribal violence, including murder, kidnapping, and enslavement. As the son in an outcast family left to die on the steppes, he probably encountered no more than a few hundred people in his entire childhood, and he received no formal education. From this harsh setting, he learned, in dreadful detail, the full range of human emotion, desire, ambition, and cruelty. While still a child, he killed his older half-brother, was captured and enslaved by a rival clan, and managed to escape from his captors. Under such horrific conditions, the boy showed an instinct for survival and self-preservation, but he showed little promise of the achievements he would one day make. As a child, he feared dogs and he cried easily. His younger brother was stronger than he was and a better archer and wrestler. His half-brother bossed him around and picked on him. Yet from these degraded circumstances of hunger, humiliation, kidnapping, and slavery, he began the long climb to power. Before reaching puberty, he had already formed the two most important relationships of his life. He swore eternal friendship and allegiance to a slightly older boy who became the closest friend of his youth, but turned into the most dedicated enemy of his adulthood. And he found the girl whom he would love forever and whom he made the mother of emperors. The dual capacity for friendship and enmity forged in Genghis Khan's youth endured throughout his life and became the defining trait of his character. The tormenting questions of love and paternity that arose beneath a shared blanket or in the flickering firelight of the family hearth became projected onto the larger stage of world history. His personal goals, desires, and fears engulfed the world. Year by year, he gradually defeated everyone more powerful than he was, until he had conquered every tribe on the Mongolian steppe. At the age of 50, when most great conquerors had already put their fighting days behind him, Genghis Khan's spirit banner beckoned him out of his remote homeland to confront the armies of the civilized people who had harassed and enslaved the nomadic tribes for centuries. In the remaining years of life, he followed that spirit banner to repeated victory across the Gobi and the Yellow River into the kingdoms of China, through the Central Asian lands of the Turks and the Persians, and across the mountains of Afghanistan to the Indus River. In conquest after conquest, the Mongol army transformed warfare into an intercontinental affair fought on multiple fronts stretching across thousands of miles. Genghis Khan's innovative fighting techniques made the heavily armored knights of medieval Europe obsolete, replacing them with disciplined cavalry moving in coordinated units. Rather than relying on defensive fortifications, he made brilliant use of speed and surprise on the battlefield, as well as perfecting siege warfare to such a degree that he ended the era of walled cities. Genghis Khan taught his people not only to fight across incredible distances, but to sustain their campaign over years, decades, and eventually more than three generations of constant fighting. In 25 years, the Mongol army subjugated more lands and people than the Romans had conquered in 400 years. Genghis Khan, together with his sons and grandsons, conquered the most densely populated civilizations of the 13th century. Whether measured by the total number of people defeated, the sum of the countries annexed, or by the total area occupied, Genghis Khan conquered more than twice as much as any other man in history. The hooves of the Mongol warriors' horses splashed in the waters of every river and lake from the Pacific Ocean to the Mediterranean Sea. At its zenith, the empire covered between 11 and 12 million contiguous square miles, an area about the size of the African continent and considerably larger than North America, including the United States, Canada, Mexico, Central America, and the islands of the Caribbean combined. It stretched from the snowy tundra of Siberia to the hot plains of India, from the rice paddies of Vietnam to the wheat fields of Hungary, and from Korea to the Balkans. The majority of people today live in countries conquered by the Mongols. On the modern map, Genghis Khan's conquests include 30 countries with well over 3 billion people. The most astonishing aspect of this achievement is that the entire Mongol tribe under him numbered around 1 million, smaller than the workforce of some modern corporations. From this million, he recruited his army, which was comprised of no more than 100,000 warriors. a group that could comfortably fit into the larger sports stadiums of the modern era. In American terms, the accomplishment of Genghis Khan might be understood if the United States, instead of being created by a group of educated merchants or wealthy planters, had been founded by one of its illiterate slaves, who, by the sheer force of personality, charisma, and determination, liberated America from foreign rule, united the people, created an alphabet, wrote the Constitution, established universal religious freedom, invented a new system of warfare, marched an army from Canada to Brazil, and opened roads of commerce in a free trade zone that stretched across the continents. On every level and from any perspective, the scale and scope of Genghis Khan's accomplishments challenge the limits of imagination and tax the resources of scholarly explanation. As Genghis Khan's cavalry charged across the 13th century, he redrew the boundaries of the world. His architecture was not in stone, but in nations. Unsatisfied with the vast number of little kingdoms, Genghis Khan consolidated smaller countries into larger ones. In Eastern Europe, the Mongols united a dozen Slavic principalities and cities into one large Russian state. In Eastern Asia, over a span of three generations, they created the country of China by weaving together the remnants of the Song dynasty in the south with the lands of the Jurchen in Manchuria, Tibet in the west, the Tangut kingdom adjacent to the Gobi, and the Uyghur lands of eastern Turkestan. As the Mongols expanded their rule, they created countries such as Korea and India that have survived to modern times in approximately the same borders fashioned by their Mongol conquerors. Genghis Khan's empire connected and amalgamated the many civilizations around him into a new world order. At the time of his birth in 1162, the old world consisted of a series of regional civilizations, each of which could claim virtually no knowledge of any civilization beyond its closest neighbor. No one in China had heard of Europe, and no one in Europe had heard of China. So far as is known, no person had made the journey from one to the other. By the time of his death in 1227, he had connected them with diplomatic and commercial contacts that still remain unbroken. As he smashed the feudal system of aristocratic privilege and birth, he built a new and unique system based on individual merit, loyalty, and achievement. He took the disjointed and languorous trading towns along the Silk Route and organized them into history's largest free trade zone. He lowered taxes for everyone and abolished them altogether for doctors, teachers, priests, and educational institutions. He established a regular census and created the first intercontinental postal system. His was not an empire that hoarded wealth and treasure. Instead, he widely distributed the goods acquired in combat so that they could make their way back into commercial circulation. He created an international law and recognized the ultimate supreme law of the eternal blue sky over all people. At a time when most rulers considered themselves to be above the law, Genghis Khan insisted on laws holding rulers as equally accountable as the lowest herder. He granted religious freedom within his realms, though he demanded total loyalty from conquered subjects of all religions. He insisted on the rule of law and abolished torture, but he mounted major campaigns to seek out and kill raiding bandits and terrorist assassins. He refused to hold hostages and, instead, instituted the novel practice of granting diplomatic immunity for all ambassadors and envoys, including those from hostile nations with whom he was at war. Genghis Khan left his empire with such a firm foundation that it continued growing for another 150 years. Then, in the centuries that followed its collapse, his descendants continued to rule a variety of smaller empires and large countries from Russia, Turkey, and India to China and Persia. They held an eclectic assortment of titles, including Khan, emperor, sultan, king, shah, emir, and the Dalai Lama. Vestiges of his empire remained under the rule of his descendants for 7 centuries. As the Mughals, some of them reigned in India until 1857, when the British drove out Emperor Bahadur Shah II and chopped off the heads of 2 of his sons and his grandson. Genghis Khan's last ruling descendant, Alim Khan, Emir of Bukhara, remained in power in Uzbekistan until deposed in 1920 by the rising tide of Soviet revolution. History has condemned most conquerors to miserable, untimely deaths. At age 33, Alexander the Great died under mysterious circumstances in Babylon, while his followers killed off his family and carved up his lands. Julius Caesar's fellow aristocrats and former allies stabbed him to death in the chamber of the Roman Senate. After enduring the destruction and reversal of all his conquests, a lonely and embittered Napoleon faced death as a solitary prisoner on one of the most remote and inaccessible islands on the planet. The nearly 70-year-old Genghis Khan, however, passed away in his camp bed, surrounded by a loving family, faithful friends, and loyal soldiers, ready to risk their life at his command. In the summer of 1227, during a campaign against the Tangut nation along the upper reaches of the Yellow River, Genghis Khan died, or, in the words of the Mongols, who have an abhorrence of mentioning death or illness, he ascended into heaven. In the years after his death, the sustained secrecy about the cause of death invited speculation and later inspired legends that with the veneer of time often appeared as historic fact. Plano de Carpini, the first European envoy to the Mongols, wrote that Genghis Khan died when he was struck by lightning. Marco Polo, who traveled extensively in the Mongol Empire during the reign of Genghis Khan's grandson, Hubalai, reported that Genghis Khan succumbed from an arrow wound to the knee. Some claimed that unknown enemies had poisoned him. Another account asserted that he had been killed by a magic spell of the Tangut king against whom he was fighting. One of the stories circulated by his detractors asserted that the captured Tangut queen inserted a contraption into her vagina so that when Genghis Khan had sex with her, it tore off his sex organs and he died in hideous pain. Contrary to the many stories about his demise, his death in a nomad's gear, essentially similar to the one in which he had been born, illustrated how successful he had been in preserving the traditional way of life of his people. Yet, ironically, in the process of preserving their lifestyle, he had transformed human society. Genghis Khan's soldiers escorted the body of their fallen Khan back to his homeland in Mongolia for secret burial. After his death, his followers buried him anonymously in the soil of his homeland without a mausoleum, a temple, a pyramid, or so much as a small tombstone to mark the place where he lay. According to Mongol belief, the body of the dead should be left in peace and did not need a monument because the soul was no longer there. It lived on in the spirit banner. At burial, Genghis Khan disappeared silently back into the vast landscape of Mongolia from whence he came. The final destination remained unknown, but in the absence of reliable information, people freely invented their own history, with many dramatic flourishes to the story. An often repeated account maintains that the soldiers in his funeral cortege killed every person and animal encountered on the 40-day journey, and that after the secret burial, 800 horsemen trampled repeatedly over the area to obscure the location of the grave. Then, according to these imaginative accounts, the horsemen were in turn killed by yet another set of soldiers so that they could not report the location of the site. And then in turn, those soldiers were slain by yet another set of warriors. After the secret burial in his homeland, soldiers sealed off the entire area for several hundred square miles. No one could enter except members of Genghis Khan's family and a tribe of specially trained warriors who were stationed there to kill every intruder. For nearly 800 years, this area, the Ikhorik, the great taboo deep in the heart of Asia, remained closed. All the secrets of Genghis Khan's empire seemed to have been locked up inside his mysterious homeland. Long after the Mongol Empire collapsed and other foreign armies invaded parts of Mongolia, the Mongols prevented anyone from entering the sacred precinct of their ancestor. Despite the eventual conversion of the Mongols to Buddhism, his successors nevertheless refused to allow priests to build a shrine, a monastery, or a memorial to mark his burial. In the 20th century, to assure that the area of Genghis Khan's birth and burial did not become a rallying point for nationalists, the Soviet rulers kept it securely guarded. Instead of calling it the Great Taboo, or using one of the historic names that might hint at a connection to Genghis Khan, the Soviets called it by the bureaucratic designation of Highly Restricted Area. Administratively, they separated it from the surrounding province and placed it under the direct supervision of the central government that, in turn, was tightly controlled from Moscow. The Soviets further sealed it off by surrounding 1 million hectares of the highly restricted area with an equally large restricted area. To prevent travel within the area, the government built neither roads nor bridges during the communist era. The Soviets maintained a highly fortified MiG air base and quite probably a storehouse of nuclear weapons between the restricted area and the Mongolian capital, Ulaanbaatar. A large Soviet tank base blocked the entrance into the forbidden zone, and the Russian military used the area for artillery practice and tank maneuvers. The Mongols made no technological breakthroughs, founded no new religions, wrote few books or dramas, and gave the world no new crops or methods of agriculture. Their own craftsmen could not weave cloth, cast metal, make pottery, or even bake bread. They manufactured neither porcelain nor pottery, painted no pictures, and built no buildings. Yet, as their army conquered culture after culture, they collected and passed all of these skills from one civilization to the next. The only permanent structures Genghis Khan erected were bridges. Although he spurned the building of castles, forts, cities, or walls as he moved across the landscape, he probably built more bridges than any ruler in history. He spanned hundreds of streams and rivers in order to make the movement of his armies and goods quicker. The Mongols deliberately opened the world to a new commerce, not only in goods, but also in ideas and knowledge. The Mongols brought German miners to China and Chinese doctors to Persia. The transfers ranged from the monumental to the trivial. They spread the use of carpets everywhere they went and transplanted lemons and carrots from Persia to China, as well as noodles, playing cards, and tea from China to the West. They brought a metal worker from Paris to build a fountain on the dry steppes of Mongolia, recruited an English nobleman to serve as interpreter in their army, and took the practice of Chinese fingerprinting to Persia. They financed the building of Christian churches in China, Buddhist temples and stupas in Persia, and Muslim Quranic schools in Russia. The Mongols swept across the globe as conquerors, but also as civilization's unrivaled cultural carriers. The Mongols, who inherited Genghis Khan's empire, exercised a determined drive to move products and commodities around and to combine them in ways that produced entirely novel products and unprecedented invention. When their highly skilled engineers from China, Persia, and Europe combined Chinese gunpowder with Muslim flamethrowers and applied European bell-casting technology, they produced the cannon, an entirely new order of technological innovation from which sprang the vast modern arsenal of weapons from pistols to missiles. While each item had some significance, the larger impact came in the way the Mongols selected and combined technologies to create unusual hybrids. The Mongols displayed a devoutly and persistently internationalist zeal in their political, economic, and intellectual endeavors. They sought not merely to conquer the world, but to institute a global order based on free trade, a single international law, and a universal alphabet with which to write all languages. Genghis Khan's grandson, Kublai Khan, introduced a paper currency intended for use everywhere, and attempted to create primary schools for universal basic education of all children in order to make everyone literate. The Mongols refined and combined calendars to create a 10,000-year calendar more accurate than any previous one, and they sponsored the most extensive maps ever assembled. The Mongols encouraged merchants to set out by land to reach their empire, and they sent out explorers across land and sea as far as Africa to expand their commercial and diplomatic reach. In nearly every country touched by the Mongols, the initial destruction and shock of conquest by an unknown and barbaric tribe yielded quickly to an unprecedented rise in cultural communication, expanded trade, and improved civilization. In Europe, the Mongols slaughtered the aristocratic knighthood of the continent, but disappointed with the general poverty of the area compared with the Chinese and Muslim countries, turned away and did not bother to conquer the cities, loot the countries, or incorporate them into the expanding empire. In the end, Europe suffered the least yet acquired all the advantages of contact through merchants, such as the Polo family of Venice and envoys exchanged between the Mongol Khans and the popes and kings of Europe. The new technology, knowledge, and commercial wealth created the Renaissance in which Europe rediscovered some of its prior culture, but more importantly, absorbed the technology for printing, firearms, the compass, and the abacus from the East. As English scientist Roger Bacon observed in the 13th century, the Mongols succeeded not merely from martial superiority, rather, they have succeeded by means of science. Although the Mongols are eager for war, they have advanced so far because they devote their leisure to the principles of philosophy. Seemingly every aspect of European life, technology, warfare, clothing, commerce, food, art, literature, and music, changed during the Renaissance as a result of the Mongol influence. In addition to new forms of fighting, new machines, and new foods, even the most mundane aspects of daily life changed as the Europeans switched to Mongol fabrics, wearing pants and jackets instead of tunics and robes, played their musical instruments with the step bow rather than plucking them with the fingers, and painted their pictures in a new style. The Europeans even picked up the Mongol exclamation, "Hooray!" as an enthusiastic cry of bravado and mutual encouragement. With so many accomplishments by the Mongols, it hardly seems surprising that Geoffrey Chaucer, the first author in the English language, devoted the longest story in the Canterbury Tales to the Asian conqueror Genghis Khan of the Mongols. He wrote in undisguised awe of him and his accomplishments. Yet, in fact, we are surprised that the learned men of the Renaissance could make such comments about the Mongols, whom the rest of the world now view as the quintessential bloodthirsty barbarians. The portrait of the Mongols left by Chaucer or Bacon bears little resemblance to the images we know from later books or films that portray Genghis Khan and his army as savage hordes lusting after gold, women, and blood. Despite the many images and pictures of Genghis Khan made in subsequent years, we have no portrait of him made within his lifetime. Unlike any other conqueror in history, Genghis Khan never allowed anyone to paint his portrait, sculpt his image, or engrave his name or likeness on a coin, and the only description of him from contemporaries are more intriguing than informative. In the words of a modern Mongolian song about Genghis Khan, "We imagined your appearance, but our minds were blank." Without portraits of Genghis Khan or any Mongol record, the world was left to imagine him as it wished. No one dared to paint his image until half a century after his death, and then each culture projected its particular image of him. The Chinese portrayed him as an avuncular elderly man with a wispy beard and empty eyes who looked more like a distracted Chinese sage than a fierce Mongol warrior. A Persian miniaturist portrayed him as a Turkish sultan seated on a throne. The Europeans pictured him as the quintessential barbarian with a fierce visage and fixed, cruel eyes, ugly in every detail. Mongol secrecy bequeathed a daunting task to future historians who wish to write about Genghis Khan and his empire. Biographers and historians had so little under which to base an account. They knew the chronology of cities conquered and armies defeated, yet little reliable information existed regarding his origin, his character, his motivation, or his personal life. Through the centuries, unsubstantiated rumors maintained that soon after his death, information on all these aspects of Genghis Khan's life had been written in a secret document by someone close to him. Chinese and Persian scholars referred to the existence of the mysterious document, and some scholars claimed to have seen it during the apex of the Mongol Empire. Nearly a century after Genghis Khan's death, the Persian historian Rashid ad-Din, describing the writings as an authentic chronicle written in the Mongolian idiom and letters. But he warned that it was guarded in the treasury where it was hidden and concealed from outsiders. He stressed that no one who might have understood and penetrated the Mongol text was given the opportunity. Following the collapse of Mongol rule, most traces of the secret document seemed to have disappeared, and in time, many of the best scholars came to believe that such a text never existed, that it was merely one more of the many myths about Genghis Khan. Just as the imaginative painters of various countries portrayed him differently, the scholars did likewise. From Korea to Armenia, they composed all manner of myths and fanciful stories about Genghis Khan's life. In the absence of reliable information, they projected their own fears and phobias onto these accounts. With the passage of centuries, scholars weighed the atrocities and aggression committed by men such as Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne, or Napoleon against their accomplishments or their special mission in history. For Genghis Khan and the Mongols, however, their achievements lay forgotten, while their alleged crimes and brutality became magnified. Genghis Khan became the stereotype of the barbarian, the bloody savage, the ruthless conqueror who enjoyed destruction for its own sake. Genghis Khan, his Mongol horde, and to a large extent the Asian people in general, became unidimensional characters, the symbol of all that lay beyond the civilized pale. By the time of the Enlightenment, at the end of the 18th century, this menacing image appeared in Voltaire's The Orphan of China, a play about Genghis Khan's conquest of China. He is called the King of Kings, the fiery Genghis Khan who lays the fertile fields of Asia waste. In contrast to Chaucer's praise for Genghis Khan, Voltaire described him as this destructive tyrant who proudly treads on the necks of kings, but is yet no more than a wild Scythian soldier bred to arms and practiced in the trade of blood. Act 1, Scene 1. Voltaire portrayed Genghis Khan as a man resentful of the superior virtues of the civilization around him and motivated by the basic barbarian desire to ravish civilized women and destroy what he could not understand. The tribe of Genghis Khan acquired a variety of names: Tartar, Tatar, Mughal, Mogul, Moal, and Mongol. But the name always carried an odious curse. When 19th-century scientists wanted to show the inferiority of the Asian and American Indian populations, they classified them as Mongolian. When doctors wanted to account for why mothers of the superior white race could give birth to retarded children, the children's facial characteristics made obvious that one of the child's ancestors had been raped by a Mongol warrior. Such blighted children were not white at all, but members of the Mongoloid race. When the richest capitalists flaunted their wealth and showed anti-democratic or anti-egalitarian values, they were derided as Moguls, the Persian name for Mongols. In due course, the Mongols became scapegoats for other nations' failures and shortcomings. When Russia could not keep up with the technology of the West or the military power of Imperial Japan, it was because of the terrible Tatar yoke put on her by Genghis Khan. When Persia fell behind its neighbors, it was because the Mongols had destroyed its irrigation system. When China lagged behind Japan and Europe, the cause was the cruel exploitation and repression by its Mongol and Manchu overlords. When India could not resist British colonization, it was because of the rapacious greed of the Mughal rule. In the 20th century, Arab politicians even assured their followers that Muslims would have invented the atomic bomb before the Americans if only the Mongols had not burned the Arabs' magnificent libraries and leveled their cities. When American bombs and missiles drove the Taliban from power in Afghanistan in 2002, the Taliban soldiers equated the American invasion with that of the Mongols, and therefore, in angry revenge, massacred thousands of Hazara, the descendants of the Mongol army who had lived in Afghanistan for 8 centuries. During the following year, in one of his final addresses to the Iraqi people, dictator Saddam Hussein made similar charges against the Mongols as the Americans moved to invade his country and remove him from power. Amid so much political rhetoric, pseudoscience, and scholarly imagination, the truth of Genghis Khan remained buried, seemingly lost to posterity. His homeland and the area where he rose to power remained closed to the outside world by the communists of the 20th century, who kept it as tightly sealed as the warriors had done during the prior centuries. The original Mongolian documents, the so-called secret history of the Mongols, were not only secret, but had disappeared, faded into the depths of history, even more mysteriously than Genghis Khan's tomb. In the 20th century, two developments gave the unexpected opportunity to solve some of the mysteries and correct part of the record about Genghis Khan. The first development was the deciphering of manuscripts containing the valuable lost history of Genghis Khan. Despite the prejudice and ignorance regarding the Mongols, scholars throughout the centuries had reported occasional encounters with the fabled Mongol text on the life of Genghis Khan. Like some rare animal or precious bird thought to have been extinct, the rumored sightings provoked more skepticism than scholarship. Finally, in the 19th century, a copy of the document written in Chinese characters was found in Beijing. Scholars easily read the characters, but the words made no sense because they had been recorded in a code that used Chinese characters to represent Mongolian sounds of the 13th century. The scholars could read only a small Chinese language summary that accompanied each chapter. These offered tantalizing hints at the story in the text, but otherwise the document remained inexplicable. Because of the mystery surrounding the documents, scholars referred to it as the secret history of the Mongols, the name by which it has continued to be known. Throughout most of the 20th century, the deciphering of the secret history remained mortally dangerous in Mongolia. Communist authorities kept the book beyond the hands of common people and scholars for fear that they might be improperly influenced by the antiquated, unscientific, and non-socialist perspective of the text. But an underground scholarly movement grew around the secret history. In nomadic camps across the steppe, the whispered story of the newfound history spread from person to person, from camp to camp. At last they had a history that told their story from the Mongol perspective. The Mongols had been much more than barbarians who harassed the superior civilizations around them. For the Mongol nomads, the revelations of the secret history seemed to come from Genghis Khan himself, who had returned to his people to offer them hope and inspiration. After more than 7 centuries of silence, they could at last hear his words again. Despite official communist repression, the Mongol people seemed determined that they would not lose these words again. For a brief moment, the liberalization of political life following the death of Stalin in 1953 and the admission of Mongolia to the United Nations in 1961 emboldened the Mongol people, and they felt free to re-explore their history. The country prepared a small series of stamps in 1962 to commemorate the 800th anniversary of the birth of Genghis Khan. Tomorrowchur, the second-highest-ranking member of the government, authorized the erection of a concrete monument to mark the birthplace of Genghis Khan near the Onon River, and he sponsored a conference of scholars to assess the good and the bad aspects of the Mongol Empire in history. Both the stamp and the simple line drawing on the monument portrayed the image of the missing Sult of Genghis Khan, the horsehair spirit banner with which he conquered and the resting place of his soul. Still, after 8 centuries, the Sult carried such a deep emotional meaning to both the Mongols and to some of the people they had conquered that the Russians treated its mere display on a stamp as an act of nationalist revival and potential aggression. The Soviets reacted with irrational anger to the fear that their satellite state might pursue an independent path, or, worse yet, side with Mongolia's other neighbor, China, the Soviet Union's erstwhile ally-turned-enemy. In Mongolia, the communist authorities suppressed the stamps and the scholars for his traitorous crime of showing what party officials labeled as tendencies directed at idealizing the role of Genghis Khan. The authorities removed Temuroctur from office.